Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Eric Dreitzer, an independent analyst and writer who assesses the political upheaval in Ukraine and the growing influence some extreme right-wing groups now have as part of the opposition coalition as the nation confronts a deep economic crisis. Steve Elner, professor of economic history at the Universidad de Oriente in Puerto La Cruz, Venezuela, who discusses recent anti-government protests and violence in Venezuela with a focus on opposition groups' objectives and their relationship with Washington. And Nick Neihard, president of Public Campaign, who talks about reform legislation being proposed to counter the flood of unlimited and unaccountable corporate money now flowing to candidates in U.S. election campaigns. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Russian environmentalist Yevgeny Fetishko, a leading critic of the development projects built for the Sochi Olympics, went on a hunger strike to protest his 3-year prison sentence. Amnesty International has called Fetishko, a researcher of Environmental Watch of the North Caucasus, a prisoner of conscience and demanded his immediate and unconditional release. Fetishko, who wrote a critical report on the environmental impact of the Sochi Olympics, was convicted in 2012 for defacing a fence that surrounds a vacation home of a regional governor that was illegally built in a national park. Yulia Gorbanova of Human Rights Watch criticized Russian authorities for continuing to harass Fetishko because they were trying to silence and extract retribution against certain persistent critics of the preparation of the Olympics. The Environmental Watch report chronicled the environmental damage in the construction of Olympic facilities, including ski runs built inside the Sochi National Park. Last year, authorities froze an Environmental Watch bank account with funds provided for the study by the Colorado-based group Global Green Grants. 4 years ago, Laura Garcia drove to a nightclub in Iguala, Mexico, where she saw military trucks and SUVs fleeing the scene. Inside, the club's office had been ransacked, and Garcia's brother, along with 5 other club employees, were missing. Garcia's brother was never found. According to the Christian Science Monitor, this is one of thousands of cases of forced disappearances carried out by the Mexican military since 2006, when then-President Felipe Calderón put the army on the front lines of the war against drug traffickers. The military was brought in due to the ineffectiveness and corruption of police. But since the military's involvement, the level of violence in Mexico has risen dramatically. Across Latin America, governments are militarizing police operations to confront drugs and violence. Ironically, this comes after decades of military dictatorship and bloody civil wars, where soldiers were directly responsible for kidnappings, torture, and mass killings in nations including Chile, Argentina, Guatemala, and El Salvador. Using soldiers for law enforcement should not be seen as a long-term solution, observed Alejandro Hope, a top Mexican security analyst. He asserts that the military is not the solution. The military is substituting for the police, who abdicate their responsibilities. Part-time cook Pedro Rochas was brought up on charges in San Antonio's immigration court after he tried to buy a Social Security card in order to keep his job at a nursing home near Austin, Texas. Rochas, who now has a wife and children in Texas, faces deportation and a criminal record. In 2013, nearly 370,000 undocumented immigrants were deported by the Obama administration, a sharp increase of 9 times over the number deported 20 years ago. At the same time, the number of migrants coming to the U.S. from Mexico and Latin America fell significantly after the Great Recession struck in 2008. The Economist magazine reports President Obama, who supports immigration reform, is in a difficult spot. Immigration advocates complain Obama has callously increased the number of deportations, while conservative Republicans in Congress accuse the administration of refusing to enforce the nation's immigration laws. However, few Americans know that the number of people deported annually is largely determined by the number of beds available in detention centers, many of them run by private companies, which are the holding pens for the people America expels. Each year, Congress mandates funding for a certain number of beds for immigration detention and stipulates that the occupancy rate must be kept high. In 2013, that number was 34,000. The president asks for less funding in his budgets, but Congress allocates more. bowing to the political appeal in Washington of spending increased funds on border security. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
After occupying Liberation Square in Ukraine's capital, Kiev, for 3 months, escalating street battles between protesters and police resulted in more than 85 deaths. The violence and loss of life, which grew out of opposition to Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych's abandonment of a proposed trade deal with the European Union, brought down the government and sent the deposed president, now facing charges of mass murder, into hiding. Ukraine, now close to bankruptcy and nearly $73 billion in debt, is a divided nation with half the population in the West identifying with Europe, while Ukrainians in the East and South, culturally and linguistically, have closer ties to Russia. After President Yanukovych secured a $15 billion bailout deal with Moscow in December, protests escalated. Now with Russian aid suspended and opposition parties trying to form a new government before elections in May, Ukraine's new leaders are seeking $35 billion in aid from the International Monetary Fund, the EU, and U.S., but that funding, if provided, will come with unpopular strings attached in the form of harsh austerity measures. Your reporter spoke with Eric Dratzer, an independent geopolitical analyst and founder of the website StopImperialism.org, who assesses the political upheaval in Ukraine and the growing influence some extreme right-wing and neo-Nazi groups now have as part of the opposition coalition, as the nation confronts a deep economic crisis.
The reductionistic view that the U.S. corporate media takes is one that it's not simply because they don't understand it. It's because they're pushing a particular narrative. And the narrative has a geopolitical dimension. At the broadest level, the narrative is an anti-Russian one. That is to say, the Yanukovych government representing some sort of a surrogate for Vladimir Putin and the Russian government. Therefore, everything that the democratically elected, albeit corrupt, government of Ukraine under President Yanukovych, everything that they did was bad, was the representation of evil, and anyone in opposition to them is good, is democracy, is an activist or something like this. But of course, the truth is far from that. In fact, the opposition is made up of a number of different elements. Some of them, what I would call more liberally minded, Western inclined elements, typified by a few of the opposition leaders, in particular the well-known celebrity Vitaly Klitschko, the former champion boxer, but also some other pretty well-known individuals like a man by the name of Arseniy Yatsenyuk, who is the noted in the Victoria Nuland recorded, I guess we could call it leaked conversation that she had, in which he was supposed to be their handpicked successor to lead the Ukrainian government. So there's a number of individuals that represent the so-called liberal wing of the opposition, and these were the ones who were being put forward by the U.S. media and the narrative that they were putting together. However, there is another very insidious element that is actually, I would argue, in the driver's seat of the opposition, and these would be the fascist and neo-Nazi elements who have tremendous amount of sway on the ground. A number of different organizations, some of them organized political parties, others organized street mobs, and various others somewhere in between. And they are the ones that you actually see if you look at the footage coming out of the Maidan Square in Kiev. They are the ones who have been engaged in the violent struggle against the police and so forth. And some groups that listeners need to be aware of, the Right Sector, which is a broad neo-Nazi organization. They were some of the most prevalent in engaging in the violence. The Svoboda or Freedom Party is a neo-Nazi political party that has deep ties to the historic Ukrainian so-called nationalism going back to their collaboration with the Nazis in World War II. These elements, whether they're a minority, whether they're a majority, they're the ones who are really driving events on the ground.
Eric, one of the major issues that brought on this crisis in Ukraine was the decision the Ukrainian government had to make about whether to move toward Russia or the European Union. to bail itself out of this horrendous debt. It's got $73 billion in debt, it's estimated. And Russia offered $15 billion. The European Union offered substantially less, and a prescription of International Monetary Fund austerity policies like we've seen unfold in places like Greece and Italy and Spain. The Ukraine is a divided nation, with culturally and by language and familial ties, the eastern and southern part of the country closely linked with Russia, and the west and Kiev linked more closely to Europe. Why is it not possible that instead of having an up and down choice between Europe and Russia, there couldn't have been some accommodation made so that Ukraine could have association with both Europe and Russia?
Well, that's precisely what should have happened. But again, your analysis presumes that Europe was looking for some kind of a rational agreement, which they were not. They were essentially creating a blackmail scenario where they were forcing Ukraine to choose one side or the other, knowing that it would put the Ukrainian government in a very untenable position. Now, what could have happened would have been a sort of a tripartite agreement where, like, for instance, like what Canada has, where Canada participates in NATO, but Canada also has agreements with Europe and with other parties outside of the NAFTA agreement. You could have had something very similar to that in Ukraine, where Ukraine had a partnership agreement with Europe, but also with the customs union of Russia and the other former Soviet republics. And you could have had some kind of an accommodation. But of course, that wouldn't have served the geopolitical strategy of the United States and their European allies, because by making Ukraine choose, they forced the government to side with Russia, thereby inciting the destabilization campaign that they were looking for. Ukraine did not have the choice to go with both sides. They were forced to choose. And of course, I think, in my judgment, the United States and the European Union knew full well that Yanukovych would side with Russia.
That was Eric Dratzer, an independent geopolitical analyst and founder of the website StopImperialism.org. For more perspectives on the crisis in Ukraine, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After anti-government protests took to the streets in western Venezuela early in February, they spread to other parts of the oil-rich nation, where violence has broken out between many middle-class students and police. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, who has been in office just 10 months after his predecessor and mentor Hugo Chavez lost his battle with cancer last March, has vowed to quell the violence while also calling for peace talks with opposition groups. More than a dozen people on both sides have been killed, with an estimated 150 injured and 500 arrests. Protesters have demanded Maduro's resignation over a rising crime rate, high inflation, and a shortage of food and other basic goods. But Maduro, elected by a small margin in April following Chavez's death, has accused the United States of fomenting the unrest and expelled three American embassy staff who he says have encouraged opposition protests. The U.S., in turn, recently expelled three Venezuelan diplomats from Washington. Protest leader Leopoldo Lopez, arrested after a demonstration he led devolved into rock-throwing and arson, is associated with the unsuccessful U.S.-supported coup attempt against Hugo Chavez in April 2002. Despite U.S. government and media sympathy for the protesters, Maduro retains substantial support from Venezuela's poor majority, who have benefited from his United Socialist Party social programs. Your reporter spoke with Steve Elner, professor of economic history at the Universidad de Oriente in Puerto La Cruz, Venezuela, who discusses the anti-government protests and violence in Venezuela with a focus on opposition groups' objectives and their relationship with Washington.
The protests were actually surprising. I think they took the whole country by surprise because elections had just taken place in December. And the Chavistas did quite well. They received a vote about 10 percentage points above the United Opposition. So it looked like at that point that the government of Nicolas Maduro was firmly in control. But there is a problem of ongoing shortages, and it has intensified in the last several months. So that outbreaks of violence took place in the border state of Táchira, bordering on Colombia, 2 weeks ago, And they spread throughout the country, especially the western part of Venezuela, a little bit in the eastern part as well, and certainly the capital city of Caracas. One aspect of these protests that I may emphasize is that they're almost exclusively taking place in middle-class and upper-middle-class areas. You know, the barrios where the poor people live and the popular sectors are concentrated are almost 100% exempt from the violence that is taking place. For instance, in Caracas is neatly divided. The eastern part of Caracas is mostly middle and upper middle class, and the western part of Caracas is exclusively popular sectors, as well as the downtown area. And the violence in Venezuela, in Caracas, the protests and the disruptions have taken place pretty much exclusively in the eastern part of Caracas. The same thing in the industrial city of Ciudad Guayana. It's divided, the Caroní River divides it between San Felix, which is popular and has not had any violence or protests at all, and Puerto Ordaz, which is middle class and upper middle class, where considerable violence has taken place.
Now, the protesters in the streets are talking about their dissatisfaction with government policies on rising violent crime, corruption, and the shortages of food and other basic goods, as you mentioned, Steve. But what are the stated objectives of these protests?
The slogan of the protests is in Spanish, salida. Salida means exit. And the protesters are calling on the government, the president of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro, to resign. Now, you may say that, well, that means that he would resign and there'd be a constitutional process in which the second in command, according to the Constitution, would take over. But the person who would become president if Maduro were to resign is the second in command of the Chavista movement, Diosdado Cabello. And the opposition certainly is not calling for that. So that it is generally recognized by everybody, both opposition people and Chavistas and observers as well, that really what's at stake here is regime change. That's what the opposition is calling for. The protests are not really centering on specific demands. There are specific issues. You mentioned three of them, especially the lack of security, as well as the inflation and the shortages. Those are issues. But the protesters are not putting forth specific demands.
Venezuelan government officials have discussed cables leaked by WikiLeaks, some of them several years old. And U.S. government officials have responded by saying these are old and outdated and don't really relate to the current situation in Venezuela. Do we have evidence that the United States government is involved in any way in supporting these opposition groups and these sometimes violent street protests?
Yeah, these WikiLeaks documents do demonstrate U.S. not necessarily direct involvement, but certainly communication and certainly very much aware of what's happening and taking very definite positions in favor of the opposition, in favor of those who are out to destabilize Venezuela. The other point is that on several occasions, the Chavista government has expelled diplomats from Venezuela. Over the last year, this has happened twice. It just happened a few weeks ago, and it happened prior to that about 6 months ago. And one of the diplomats who was expelled from Venezuela had traveled throughout Venezuela and met with an NGO that is very much involved in the anti-Chavez movement, whose former vice president is Maria Corina Machado, who's one of the radical anti-Chavistas. And then the diplomat went to the state of Amazonas, which is one of the few states which the governor belongs to the opposition. So obviously there is activity on the part of the U.S. embassy that I think would indicate goes beyond just collecting data. There's more of an activist role. Exactly what that role is, I can't really say.
That was Steve Elner, professor of economic history at the Universidad de Oriente in Puerto La Cruz, Venezuela. He's the author of the forthcoming book, Latin America's Radical Left. Find more analysis of the situation in Venezuela by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. More than 8 months before this year's midterm congressional elections, big money is already pouring into many races. The billionaire Koch brothers-funded group Americans for Prosperity, for example, has already spent more than $8 million on negative advertisements against North Carolina's Democratic Senator Kay Hagan, who is running for a second term. The ads focus on her support for the Affordable Care Act, the program's problem-plagued launch, and misstatements made by President Obama that everyone would be allowed to keep their current insurance policies, regardless of an insurance company's power to withdraw coverage plans. Initial public opposition to Obamacare, along with confusion about the program's provisions, have provided powerful ammunition for conservatives trying to unseat Democrats. However, huge sums are now being spent by both Republican and Democratic Party donors. Among the legislative measures now being proposed in Congress to respond to the flood of unlimited and unaccountable campaign spending ushered in by the 2010 Supreme Court Citizens United decision are the Fair Elections Now Act, sponsored by Illinois Democratic Senator Dick Durbin, and the Government by the People Act, sponsored by Maryland Democratic Representative John Sarbanes. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Nick Neihardt, president of the Washington, D.C.-based group Public Campaign, which supports public funding for elections. With 17 years as an advocate of campaign finance reform, he says there's an upside to all the bad news about ever greater amounts of big money being injected into U.S. politics. Here, Neihardt discusses the latest big money infusions and the current legislative efforts to counteract their impact.
Things getting worse has meant more and more people want to solve the problem, so it's very exciting that we have more people saying, hey, what can we do? I want to help. And on the other hand, the boulder we're pushing up the hill has just gotten to be a bigger boulder on a steeper hill. But, you know, it's only going to get worse until we change the court or change the Constitution. And in addition to that, set up a small donor-based public financing system like the Fair Elections Now Act that Senator Durbin is sponsoring, or the new Government by the People Act that Representative John Sarbanes is sponsoring and just rolled out with more than 130 co-sponsors, which is a huge number. It's more than half of the votes we need on the very first day the bill was put out there.
I actually spoke to Congressman Sarbanes the day he introduced his bill, but there's been more bad news since then, filled with more big money flowing into the process. Can you talk about that?
The most recent interesting news, and something that exemplifies what's wrong with the system. Two American billionaires, one from California, Tom Steyer, who's a strong advocate for fighting back on climate change and supporting policies that would counteract climate change, vowed to put huge amounts of money, $50 million of his own money, and hopefully raising an equal amount from other people, to take on politicians who stand in the way of fighting climate change. And then just around the same time, a conservative Republican, Paul Singer, a hedge fund billionaire, announced that he also was going to jump into elections and put millions and millions of dollars into supporting strongly pro-business candidates and opposing people on he thinks are anti-business. So we've seen tens of millions of dollars come into the race, not from thousands and tens of thousands of people, but from two people pledging to run huge political operations. And this is in addition to the Koch brothers and the liberal donors that have banded together. So we're seeing a continuation of what the Roberts Court has allowed through Citizens United and a series of other decisions of opening up the political process so that big money will have more and more of an impact. And it's going to turn politics into a parlor game for billionaires if it keeps going in this direction. And there's nothing that's going to stop it from going in this direction. So when a billionaire says he's spending $50 million, it's a lot of money to you and me, but for these billionaires, it's just the beginning of what they could put into politics if they were totally, totally committed to it. So this is really bad news for ordinary Americans, because if you don't give to politicians, or even if you give $25 or $50 or $100, your voice doesn't make that much difference in the money that politicians need even more of than they did before. When someone adds tens of millions of dollars into the political contest, into the elections that are coming up this year, it means that the candidates who want to defend themselves against the super PAC attack ads need to raise more and more money. So your $100 or $25 or $5 doesn't mean too much when a candidate is trying to raise millions more for their House or Senate race. They need to go right to the lobbying interest that might write them a $2,500 check or a $1,000 check or bundle large numbers of checks like that. So we're seeing everyday people being squeezed out of politics as a result of billionaires really beginning to dominate the political warfare that we have every 2 years.
Nick Neihardt, bills have been introduced in every Congress since the Citizens United Supreme Court decision in 2010 that declared corporations and unions are people and money is a form of free speech that can't be restricted. And those bills never went anywhere. So far, the co-sponsors of both of this year's bills we've been talking about are virtually all Democrats, so I'm not sure how much chance they have of passing in Congress either. But if they should, what impact would they have on money and politics?
They begin the fight back against the Roberts Court and its string of bad decisions. They do that by matching small donations and allowing candidates to run dependent on the people back home, so that if someone goes and gets lots of $25 contributions at a backyard barbecue, that money is matched 6-1 for candidates who agree not to accept big, large contributions. So it empowers the voices of everyday people, and because of that 6-1 match, it then says to the candidate, you know what, we'll take your small donations and we'll make them add up to enough money that you can counteract the super PACs that are coming down against you. And so it gives a way for candidates to run for office being true to their constituents by being backed by lots of small donations plus matching public funds.
That was Nick Neihardt, president of the group Public Campaign. Find more information about campaign finance reform legislation on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.